Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 61. Glimmer. Rose and Jason.
Mac is following us,
Jason said to Rose with quiet intensity, grabbing her hand and pulling her along, pushing through the crowds of pedestrians on the sidewalk in front of Atavika.
We gotta go.
Where is he?
Rose asked, looking around.
He's across the street wearing a long army green coat, Yankees hat, and a mask,
Jason said. She recognized Mac immediately, having looked into his eyes when he pointed the gun in her face almost 24 hours ago.
What do we do?
I planned on taking us back to the condo, but I just realized he was the guy lingering outside of my building when we left for Atavika. Then he followed us here. How the hell does he know where I live?
Do you have somewhere else in mind?
Yeah, but we gotta ditch Mac, then we can drop into my friend's spot. It's nearby and she can help.
Who's your friend?
Rose asked as she walked briskly next to Jason.
Corrine. She's a dancer.
The same person you tried calling earlier?
Yeah, her club is in the East Village.
Rose's grasp on Manhattan geography was hazy. She had not been to the island in a while, and she usually trusted her driver, AI taxi, or GPS on her UD to guide her without thinking about it.
We can trust her?
Yes, she's a good person and a friend.
How do you know her?
Rose asked.
It's a long story, but she was there for me when I needed it.
Jason led at a brisk pace, meandering through the narrow streets. Rose looked over her shoulder and saw Mac trailing by 60 yards. Her shoulder bag hung by her waist, rhythmically knocking against her hip as she jogged.
He's right behind us.
We have one major advantage over him. We know where we're going and he doesn't,
Jason said as they scuttled along the busy sidewalks.
If we run, I think we can get some separation. He won't realize we picked up the pace until it's too late to catch up. We'll run north and cross Delancey.
Referring to a major crosstown vein of traffic.
Okay, we got this,
Rose agreed as they sped to a gallop. They weaved through the streets, ducking and dodging carts and vendors, delivery persons, hydrants, and rubbish bins. They turned onto a bustling street, with brick walk-up apartments and storefronts entrances covered by colorful awnings stenciled with Chinese characters. They hastened past graffitied parking kiosks, 6G charging stations, and steel bicycle frames chained to light poles like desiccated skeletons in a desert, all valuable parts stripped by vulture-like opportunists. Then Jason stopped so quickly Rose nearly plowed into his back.
Let's try something,
he said. The busy environment would obstruct Mac's vision, so he pulled Rose into the doorway alcove of an apartment building outside the clear line of sight from the intersection. Jason kneeled, took out his UD, and held the UD outside the alcove just enough so its camera jutted out. With the video feature on, Jason could see around the corner by looking at the UD's screen without exposing Rose or himself. The screen showed Mac in hot pursuit, but he halted at the intersection and peered down the street. After his head swiveled around, he jumped into a run along his original vector.
He's gone,
Jason said. The pair jogged until they reached busy Delancey Street, waiting until it was clear to cross. Trotting between the bumpers of cars, Rose looked toward the on-ramp to the Williamsburg Bridge on her right, which gently sloped up from Delancey, framed between large, colorful holographic billboards hanging on the buildings on either side. Even from several blocks away, she could see the giant lattices of steel cables that suspended the road hundreds of feet in the air over the river. In front of the bridge's on-ramp, she saw Mac and he was running toward them.
Mac sees us. He's running at us,
Rose exclaimed.
We gotta move,
Jason said, turning his jog into a sprint. They ran, hurdling obstacles and dodging traffic.
I don't see him anymore.
Rose scanned the streets around her, breathing hard.
It's not too much further, just another 5 or 10 minutes at this speed.
When they finally found their window to cross busy East Houston Street, Mac appeared one block behind them.
Where do we go now?
Rose asked loudly.
Run up Avenue A.
Jason could hear Rose's footfalls on the pavement syncopated with her rapid breathing. They sprinted down Avenue A until they reached 5th, turning right. Jason could see the sign for Corrine's Club. Its neon letters spelled out effigy, with the Y being an outline of a woman's figure. The neon sign glowed against the brick wall above the indigo-painted door. Pasted on the portal was a thick white-lined pop art drawing of a woman's face smiling flirtatiously, hearkening the works of Roy Lichtenstein.
"This is it,"
Jason said, hoping Corrine would be there to help them. Chapter 62. The Rat. Mac. Rounding the corner onto 5th Street, Mac could only see a few people walking on the sidewalks. There were fewer cars obstructing his view in this neighborhood, and he could see the street's entire length. He thought he saw a blur vaguely appearing to be Jason and Rose careening sharply into an establishment in the middle of the block. When he saw Jason and Rose leave Atavica, he had texted Esri that he was following them. She responded as if she had already typed the message.
"Don't lose them. I'm on my way."
But he had lost their trail, and now he was anxious that Esri would be livid when she arrived.
"Why am I the one following them if she can track Jason's UD?"
he thought, pausing for a split second to catch his breath. He jogged to where he thought he saw Rose and Jason disappear. It was a divey-looking bar with the word effigy above the door in neon lights. The door led down a flight of stairs into a large room with a bar on one side and a stage with three shiny poles fastened to the ground and ceiling on the other. A woman in a sparkling lilac thong and matching top revealing a significant portion of her breasts danced to the beat of the music that seemed to fill the room like a pulsing rhythmic fluid. Momentarily distracted by the dancer swinging seductively on the pole in the center of the stage, Max stood near the bottom of the steps and scanned for signs of Rose and Jason. Nothing. He approached the bar and stood. A diminutive platinum blonde woman strolled up to him. She wore tight pleather pants and a bikini top exposing her cleavage. She broadcast a gentle yet confident demeanor.
"Hey, bae, can I get you a drink?"
she asked Mac over the music.
"Have you seen a guy and a girl, both in masks, casually dressed, come in here in the past couple minutes? The girl had yoga pants and a shoulder bag."
The blonde woman scrunched up her eyes as if she were thinking about it.
"No, I don't think anyone with masks or yoga pants has come in recently, sorry."
"Are you sure? Nobody at all?"
"No, I can't remember seeing anyone like that,"
she replied.
"You want to sit down and I can get you a drink while you wait for them. Your friends?"
He ignored her question. Looking over her shoulder, he could see a doorway with a curtain hanging down instead of a door. A placard hovered over the door that read, "Staff Only," and a man with biceps like swollen melons sat at a wooden stool next to the curtained doorway, presumably to enforce the sign's decree. He wore black pants, black shoes, and a white V-neck t-shirt bursting from the outward pressure of his pectorals. Mac thought the curtain was likely to prevent sexually thirsty visitors from peeking into the changing areas. But he knew it would be a great hiding place if someone could sneak through.
"Nobody snuck in the back?"
he asked, again ignoring the woman's question.
"Nobody is allowed back there,"
she said, her voice taking an edge of impatience.
"I didn't see anyone, and Pritch Def won't let anyone in."
She looked at him with a tight, flat mouth. Mac walked past her toward the room.
"Jason, Rose,"
he called.
"If you're back there, come out."
The large man stood up from his stool and blocked the curtain.
"Chill the fuck out, bro. Nobody went in there."
He crossed his arms and puffed out his barrel chest. Mac looked up at the giant.
"If I swing on him, I'm not sure I can even reach his face,"
Mac thought. He craned his head around the Goliath.
"Jason, get the fuck out here."
The large man thrust his giant arm in front of Mac.
"What I tell you, man, I'll knock your ass out if you keep pushing."
Mac backpedaled and held his hands up in a sign of surrender. The woman had followed Mac and now stood next to him.
"I told you, nobody gets in there except dancers."
She put her hand on his forearm.
"Why don't you relax and have a seat somewhere? Maybe by the stage or at the bar, and I'll bring you a drink, or you can order when you're ready. Stella takes the stage in like 15. You don't want to miss it.
Vexed and exasperated, Mac exhaled loudly.
No!
He said, pulling his arm away as he turned and walked hastily up the stairs and out of the bar.
I must have lost them on Fifth Street,
Mac thought as he emerged from the bar under its neon sign. He knew that Ezri had been cleaning up the murder scene at the Pyramid Club and pressuring some of Rose and Jason's contacts to give her information, but she would be arriving soon to help find their targets.
If Ezri can't track them and they evaded us again, she may finally kill me.
Chapter 63. Wings. Rose and Jason. Dancers strutted past Rose fully dressed on their way out to perform. Others returned mostly naked after their performances had ended. Corrine had acted swiftly to hide Rose and Jason in the back room. When they had burst in, breathing heavily, Corrine glided over to them immediately.
We're in trouble. Can you hide us?
Jason had asked, forehead glistening. Rose breathed heavily next to him, a trickle of sweat suspended off the corner of her jaw. Without hesitation, Corrine escorted them to the back.
Pritch, let these two through,
she told the bouncer.
No one is back here, okay?
The large man nodded. From the back room area, Jason and Rose could hear Mac trying to pry information and argue with Corrine and the security guard. When they heard Mac exit, clearly exasperated, they locked eyes and shared a sense of relief. Moments later, Corrine came back through the curtain to the back room.
He's gone,
she said.
Thank you so much, Rose said.
Of course. I'll help Jason any way I can.
Rose saw mirrors and lights everywhere, and for some reason they reminded her that she knew little about Jason. She did not know his backstory, his hobbies, or his motivations.
How did you and Jason meet?
She asked. Corrine half smiled and glanced at Jason.
He came in here one time in the late fall, or early winter of last year. Anyway, he looked kinda rough. He was drinking, not watching the dancers like most people do. I had just finished my shift and was also getting a drink. I remember specifically what he said because at first, I thought it was odd. He said he was on a quest.
She made air quotations with both hands.
He was looking for some building with a red door and a pyramid symbol above it, but could not find it.
Rose turned to Jason, who she realized was staring at her, dark eyes sparkling.
He was looking for the Pyramid Club,
Rose thought.
He hadn't joined yet, so why was he searching for it?
Corrine continued to describe her initial meeting with Jason.
That day, I had gone to my fortune teller, who told me that I would help someone on a quest, and she showed me a card, a tarot card, called the Mystic Pyramid. It seemed to align with Jason's quest, so I offered to help him. We became friends, and I took him around to people in the industry who might know of a low-key speakeasy or secret UD app club with a red door and pyramid symbol.
Her expression turned serious.
This ties into something that happened to me today, something that may complicate your situation. It's one of the reasons I knew to hide you so quickly.
What is it?
Remember that night we met? I took you to a club, Disco Ardent in Dumbo, so you could talk to some more people about your quest? And that crazy bitch with the golden contact lenses almost tried to fight you? Or have her boys fight you?
Jason nodded.
She broke into my house earlier today.
Holy shit,
Jason said, eyebrow raised.
It gets even crazier,
Corrine continued.
I was terrified. She was sitting on one of the armchairs in my living room in the dark. I walked in and turned on the light, and she was just sitting there, smiling all crazy with a gun in one hand. She...
Corrine stammered.
She said that she remembered me being with you at Disco Ardent.
A shiver ran down Jason's spine.
I demanded to know what she was doing in my apartment and how she knew where I lived. She said, let's just say that people that come to my club have UDs that are really easy to track. Like, what the hell? She's tracking my fucking UD!
She exclaimed. Jason stared at Corrine without speaking for several seconds, dumbstruck. Rose looked at Jason and then Corrine.
That's horrible, but I'm confused,
Rose said, trying to put the pieces together.
Is this related to our situation somehow?
She can track UDs that have been to Disco Ardent. If that's true, she could be tracking you. You gotta be careful. She told me she was there to see if you,
gesturing at Jason,
had contacted me. She knew that we hadn't called or texted in weeks, but she wanted to see if you had visited me. I told her I hadn't seen you in a while, which is true, but she didn't believe me. She said she had looked through my UD for stuff that would show we had been together. She told me that she would be watching me. I think that was her way of scaring me, so I wouldn't help you. I am scared.
That must be how Mac found my place,
Jason said to Rose.
I never tell clients where I live. Never. But he found it somehow. I would bet Mac and that freaky golden-eyed lady are working together.
Rose could feel her lip tremble from the frustration and borderline futility of the situation, along with the pain, sorrow, and anger.
You think this is the same woman that answered Easton's UD?
Jason shrugged.
I don't know, but I think it would be on the safer side for us to assume that they are in league, and that they can track everything about our UDs.
I wish there was more I could do, but I'm terrified,
said Corrine.
We don't want to drag you into this,
Jason said.
At first, I was going to ask if we could stay with you, but it's too dangerous. You've already helped us, but even speaking with us could put you in harm's way. If I can just have a few minutes to write some key UD numbers down and plan our next move, we will get out of here.
He pulled out his UD, anxiously holding it as if it could explode with the slightest shake. In the other hand, he pulled out his small moleskin notebook. Seeing a small table pushed against the wall in the back hallway, Jason walked up to it and gently put the UD on the table next to an empty bourbon bottle. He blinked his thought lock into existence and commanded it to bring up the UD numbers for Gio, Tara, some of the other attorneys in his co-op, as well as Corrine's number just in case. He flipped past doodles and diagrams and case notes to a blank page, writing the numbers down in a scrawling hand. As Jason leaned over his notebook writing, Rose realized that some things about Jason did not quite add up. She realized she still knew little about him, but the strangest issue was that he had been seeking out the Pyramid Club before he had joined.
Why? Was it coincidence that he had become a member of the club and shortly thereafter it was destroyed? Was the fact that he saved me from Mac staged somehow? Did he have ulterior motives for joining the club as a member?
She wanted all the answers. For the time being, she was certain he was helping her. But eventually, she would confront Jason about his dissembling. Meanwhile, Corrine had approached her and was standing at her side, startling Rose out of her ruminative daze. As if detecting her suspicions, Corrine tried to reassure Rose out of earshot of Jason.
You're lucky,
she said.
He's a good man. He cares about you, I can tell. He's been through a lot. The death of his partner and his investigator friend. The abuse at his job. But the most important thing is that he's loyal, and he follows his heart.
Death of his partner and investigator friend?
Rose thought. Then she responded to Corrine.
To be honest, I don't know him that well. The past 24 hours have been a whirlwind. We haven't had a chance to talk much, except about the bad stuff.
Rose frowned. Corrine took Rose's hand.
I can see you're in pain, but can I give you my opinion?
Rose nodded.
Everything happens for a reason. I know it's lame, but I really believe it. In my heart, I can feel that the stars aligned to bring you two together.
It was an optimistic message that, for no logical reason, temporarily assuaged Rose's doubts about Jason. She did not even believe in fate or destiny, yet the hackneyed aphorism calmed her. The past day had been a blur, warping Rose's perceptions of reality. Somehow, the fact that Corrine really believed what she was saying, that it was not a platitude but a true feeling, reassured her. Jason took his UD and notebook and walked over to Rose and Corrine.
All right, I wrote down everything we need,
he said. Holding up his UD, which appeared to be off, he asked,
What should I do with this?
Is it off?
Corrine asked.
Yeah, but I've heard rumors that they can be tracked even when they're off. If it can be tracked, then it can be hacked. If that's true, then someone could remotely turn it on. I don't want to take any chances.
Let's destroy it,
Rose suggested. Jason nodded. He walked back to the table and grabbed the empty bourbon bottle. He turned away from the table, kneeled on the ground, dropped his UD in front of him, turned the bottle upside down so droplets of liquor dripped onto the floor, and grabbed the neck with his hand. He looked over at Rose and Corrine, who nodded in assent. Jason raised the bottle and bashed the UD with the bottle's bottom corner like a hammer. The UD resisted the assault for several of Jason's strikes, but it eventually gave way. Its screen shattered with shards clinking softly onto the ground. The lightweight aluminum chassis started to bend and dent. With each strike, tightly coiled wires, chipsets, and solenoids spilled out onto the floor like electronic guts. When he had reached its insides, Jason quit hitting the UD, setting the bottle down. Then he pulled his pen from his pocket and used it to pry the outer case of the UD open and ripped out its components. He turned to Corrine.
Can I have a large glass of water?
Sure,
she said, turning around and walking through the curtain to the main lounge area. She returned moments later with a tall glass.
Thanks,
Jason said. He offered a sip to Rose, who declined with a headshake, and he took a sip. Then he swept the shattered UD shards into a pile with his hands, picked them up, and dropped them into the glass of water. He picked up the UD chassis in his hand and threw it into a waste bin in the corner of the room.
That should do it,
he said. He turned to Corrine.
All right, I think we better go. Is there a back exit?
Yeah, I'll take you out that way,
Corrine said. She led them through the back room area to a door, which she opened, revealing a rear exit stairway.
This goes to the alley,
she said.
You should be able to find your way back to Fifth from here.
Jason walked over to her and they hugged.
Thanks again for your help. I owe you big time.
Just be careful.
Pulling away from Jason, she gave Jason a peck on the cheek, then looked at Rose.
It was nice to meet you, Rose. You be careful too.
I can't thank you enough,
Rose said. Corrine then stepped forward and gave her a big hug. Rose closed her eyes. The warmth and unconditional aid given by this woman made Rose feel hopeful. After she pulled away from the hug, Corrine walked back inside.
Good luck,
she said as she closed the door. Rose turned to Jason.
What do we do next?
Jason looked at Rose.
We are supposed to call Gio about a place to stay. Without a UD, we're going to try him on a payphone.
Chapter 64. Stall Out. Rose and Jason. The pair weaved through the East Village toward the subway station on 2nd Avenue and Houston.
I know where to find a payphone in Manhattan,
Jason said.
Nobody will expect us to use it.
A payphone? Those still exist?
Yeah, there's one left. We can use it to call Gio. If we had used Corrine's UD or someone else's, it would have been tracked and could have put us and our friends at risk.
He was walking quickly.
We gotta call Gio soon. He likely already tried to call my UD.
The existence of payphones astounded Rose. She could not remember ever using one, and she was skeptical that such outdated technology would be functioning.
How the hell do you know where to find a payphone in the city? How do you know that it even works?
I don't,
Jason said as they crossed the street.
But I read an article that described how New York City had around 20,000 of them in the late 2000s, but the city dismantled and removed all the payphone bays on the sidewalks, replacing them over time with Wi-Fi kiosks, 6G posts, and UD charging stations.
Do you know how to use it?
No, but I've seen them in old movies. It shouldn't be tough to operate. If it's dead, though, we may be screwed.
We don't have a UD to scan any QR codes. We won't be able to pay.
They take coins.
Like crypto coins? If there's not a way to input my wallet info, we won't be able to do that either.
Not crypto, physical coins.
Are you joking, Jason?
He pulled his hand from his jacket pocket, holding a metallic circle in his fingers.
It's a quarter. It's all we need.
Rose scrunched her eyebrows, examining the shiny little disc. Rose could not remember ever having used a coin.
This seems sus, you know that, right? I can't believe we're doing this.
I think it will work,
As they approached Houston Street, a bustling artery of foot and car traffic, Jason continued to describe how the city's Department of Informational Technology and Telecommunications maintained one solitary booth with a functioning payphone on the Upper West Side of Manhattan at West End Avenue and 66th Street. If New York City was a giant organism that continuously grew and changed, then this last remaining payphone was a strange vestigial organ not necessary for its evolution. Jason was not sure why the city kept one single phone booth. He thought maybe it was nostalgia among city officials. Payphones had been woven into the city's mystique and popular culture for around a century. By the time he finished describing the city's payphone history, they had arrived at the subway entrance and descended the dirty stairs to the station on Houston Street. As they stood on the dingy platform, waiting for the F train to take them uptown, Rose felt like the pocked, grimy wall tiles were closing in around her. The ache of Easton's death crept back into her heart. Her confidence was battered, her hope dwindled. All she wanted was to curl up in a ball on the floor and give up. The soreness of her shoulder pounded as the strap of her satchel dug into her collarbone. She could feel the weight of the Polaris diamond around her neck, which reminded her of Easton, as well as the burden of Song, the AI, his AI, that he had left to her. Suddenly, she felt the warmth of a person's touch. She looked down to see Jason's hand grasping hers, which woke her from the trance of futility. She raised her gaze up at Jason.
Rose,
he said quietly.
I know that it must be difficult to trust me and to go along with my vague plans, but I need you to know, my primary goal is to protect us. I promise you this, you can trust me to be on your team, unquestionably.
Okay.
I want you to know that there is a lot I need to tell you when the time is right. We haven't had a moment for me to explain things. But when I do, you will get why I am saying this stuff. Why I feel like I need to help.
She nodded again. She still did not understand his motivation, yet she still believed that he wanted to help. A small part of her mind nagged her, suggesting that his purpose was impure, but she dismissed it. She did not believe Jason was lulling her into complacency so he could take advantage of her somehow. If he were going to steal from her or rape her, he already had numerous opportunities. The F train arrived, whirring past them screeching. It pushed warm, dank air into their faces. They boarded with their masks and stood in the corner of the subway car. It was an older car with plexiglass poster holders mounted on the walls scratched into near obscurity and alternating mustard yellow and burnt orange seats. The train lurched forward. Rose could feel the speed of the train in her body, and she could see the subway tunnel walls streaking by like paint smearing on the belt of a treadmill. Throngs of passengers stepped onto the train while others disembarked at each stop along their route. To Rose, although the people seemed fungible like they were all the same and could be mixed and matched, Rose knew each had his or own story, and this shared moment on the subway was merely the briefest of glimpses into each of his or life. They stayed on the train until the station at 59th Street, Columbus Circle, at which point they left the train. They pushed through the exit turnstiles, climbed the stairs, and emerged in the brightly lit and bustling southwest corner of Central Park near Columbus Circle. In the dark, the park looked like a hole in the blanket of light covering the city. Across the dark expanse, Rose could see skyscraper offices, condo complexes, and arcologies like bright megalithic tree trunks towering over the park's dark flatness. In a city with little open space, the park offered people a view of the cityscape backdrop, which was not visible when from the vantage of a person in the crowd churning between the city's buildings. They crossed the street, walked uptown on Broadway, then cut through Lincoln Center, its three buildings arranged around a fountain in the center of a square. They emerged on 65th Street after cutting through the center. They moved west, dodging pedestrians, many of whom were gazing up in the air at the towering lights. When they reached 66th Street and West End, Rose pointed to the northwest corner of the street.
There.
Nestled between the streetlight post, mailbox, and sheltered bus stop, a telephone booth stood. It was a cuboid with scuffed glass panels that said phone in plain blue letters in a panel near its top. As they approached, Rose could see the phone box dulled by deep gouges in the steel, with its number pad of buttons, cable, and black telephone hanging in its cradle inside the three-walled glass enclosure. Standing in front of the booth, they looked at each other.
I guess I'll call Geo,
Jason said, looking at his watch.
It's been just over 2 hours since we left Atavica.
He stepped into the booth, Rose standing next to him. Jason unzipped his coat pocket and reached in, causing a dull metallic jingle. He pulled out a quarter. In the age of body-integrated devices, it seemed so incongruous to have to pay for anything, let alone a phone call, with a physical piece of money. Rose was used to initiating a phone call with a thought. Jason lifted the phone from its cradle and pressed it to his ear. It was silent. He pushed the quarter into the slot at the top of the phone box. The quarter sounded like it was cascading through the metal guts of the phone box until it reached the bottom with a clang. Immediately, a flat dial tone hummed in his ear. He pulled his notebook from his pocket and leafed through to a page of scribbles with Geo's number. As soon as he pressed the first numbered button, the dial tone ceased and loud mechanical-sounding beeps in the headset accompanied each pression. He finished dialing and he could hear the phone ringing in the telephone's headset. It rang 3 times before someone picked up.
Mason!
A voice sounding like Geo's answered the phone.
Geo, it's Jason.
Jason, I tried calling you, but it went straight to voicemail. You okay?
Yeah, we had to ditch our UDs. They were being tracked.
Good God. How are you contacting me right now?
A payphone.
Genius thinking. We've come full circle. The Mafia used payphones to avoid government surveillance back in the day. Anyway, I'm glad you're okay, and I found a safe place for you and Rose.
Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.